canonical Bible. For example, 19 scrolls and fragmentary manuscripts preserve parts of the book of Genesis. But many scrolls record texts that were later excluded from the Bible. For example, more than 20 scrolls and fragments preserve parts of the book of Enoch, a book allegedly written by the patriarch Enoch, the great-grandfather of Noah, and containing the history of the angels and demons, as well as a prophecy about the coming of the Messiah. The Jews of Qumran apparently gave great importance to both Genesis and Enoch, and did not think that Genesis was canonical while Enoch was apocryphal. Indeed, to this day, some Ethiopian Jewish and Christian sects consider Enoch part of their canon. Even the scrolls that record future canonical texts sometimes differ from the present-day canonical version. For example, the canonical text of Deuteronomy 32:8 says that God divided the nations of the earth according to the number of the sons of Israel. The version recorded in the Dead Sea Scrolls has the number of the sons of God instead, implying a rather startling notion that God has multiple sons. In Deuteronomy 8:6, the canonical text requires the faithful to fear God, whereas the Dead Sea version asks them to love God. Some variations are much more substantial than just a single word here or there. The Psalms scrolls contain several entire psalms that are missing from the canonical Bible, most notably Psalms 151, 154, 155. Similarly, the oldest translation of the Bible, the Greek Septuagint, completed between the 3rd and the 1st centuries BCE, is different in many ways from the later canonical version. It includes, for example, the books of Tobit, Judith, Sirach, Maccabees, the Wisdom of Solomon, the Psalms of Solomon, and Psalm 151. It also has longer versions of Daniel and Esther. Its book of Jeremiah is 15% shorter than the canonical version. Finally, in Deuteronomy 32:8, most Septuagint manuscripts have either sons of God or angels of God, rather than sons of Israel. It took centuries of hair-splitting debates among learned Jewish sages, known as rabbis, to streamline the canonical database and to decide which of the many texts in circulation would get into the Bible as the official word of Jehovah and which would be excluded. By the time of Jesus, agreement was probably reached on most of the texts, but even a century later, rabbis were still arguing whether the Song of Songs should be part of the canon or not. Some rabbis condemned that text as secular love poetry, while Rabbi Akiva, died 135 CE, defended it as the divinely inspired creation of King Solomon. Akiva famously said that the Song of Songs is the Holy of Holies. By the end of the 2nd century CE, widespread consensus was apparently reached among Jewish rabbis about which texts were part of the biblical canon and which were not. But debates about this matter, and about the precise wordings, spelling, and pronunciation of each text, were not finally resolved until the Masoretic era, 7th to 10th centuries CE. This process of canonization decided that Genesis was the word of Jehovah, but the Book of Enoch, the life of Adam and Eve, and the Testament of Abraham were human fabrications. The Psalms of King David were canonized, minus Psalms 151 to 55, but the Psalms of King Solomon were not. The Book of Malachi got the seal of approval, the Book of Baruch did not. Chronicles, yes. Maccabees, no. Interestingly, some books mentioned in the Bible itself failed to get into the canon. For example, the books of Joshua and Samuel both refer to a very ancient sacred text known as the Book of Jasher, Joshua 10:13, 2 Samuel 1:18. The Book of Numbers refers to the Book of the Wars of the Lord, Numbers 21:14. And when 2 Chronicles surveys the reign of King Solomon, it concludes by saying that the rests of the Acts of Solomon, first and last, are written in the Chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer. 2 Chronicles 9:29. The books of Iddo, Ahijah and Nathan, as well as the books of Jasher and the Wars of the Lord, aren't in the canonical Bible. Apparently, they were not excluded on purpose, they just got lost. After the canon was sealed, most Jews gradually forgot the role of human institutions in the messy process of compiling the Bible. Jewish orthodoxy maintained that God personally handed down to Moses at Mount Sinai the entire first part of the Bible, the Torah. Many rabbis further argued that God created the Torah at the very dawn of time, so that even biblical characters who lived before Moses, like Noah and Adam, read and studied it. The other parts of the Bible also came to be seen as a divinely created or divinely inspired text, totally different from ordinary human compilations. Once the Holy Book was sealed, it was hoped that Jews now had direct access to Jehovah's exact words, which no fallible human or corrupt institution could erase or alter. Anticipating the blockchain idea by 2,000 years, Jews began making numerous copies of the Holy Code, and every Jewish community was supposed to have at least one in its synagogue or its Beit Midrash, house of study. This was meant to achieve 2 things. First, disseminating many copies of the Holy Book promised to democratize religion and place strict limits on the power of would-be human autocrats. Whereas the archives of Egyptian pharaohs and Assyrian kings empowered the unfathomable kingly bureaucracy at the expense of the masses, the Jewish Holy Book seemed to give power to the masses, who could now hold even the most brazen leader accountable to God's laws. Second, and more important, having numerous copies of the same book prevented any meddling with the text. If there were thousands of identical copies in numerous locations, any attempt to change even a single letter in the Holy Code could easily be exposed as a fraud. With numerous Bibles available in far-flung locations, Jews replaced human despotism with divine sovereignty. The social order was now guaranteed by the infallible technology of the book. Or so it seemed. The institution strikes back. Even before the process of canonizing the Bible was completed, the biblical project had run into further difficulties. Agreeing on the precise contents of the Holy Book was not the only problem with this supposedly infallible technology. Another obvious problem concerned copying the text. For the Holy Book to work its magic, Jews needed to have many copies wherever they lived. With Jewish centers emerging not only in Palestine but also in Mesopotamia and Egypt, and with new Jewish communities extending from Central Asia to the Atlantic, how to make sure that copyists working thousands of kilometers apart would not change the Holy Book either on purpose or by mistake? To forestall such problems, the rabbis who canonized the Bible devised painstaking regulations for copying the Holy Book. For example, a scribe was not allowed to pause at certain critical moments in the copying process. When writing the name of God, the scribe may not respond even if the king greets him. If he was about to write 2 or 3 divine names successively, he may pause between them and respond. Rabbi Yishmael, 2nd century CE, told one copyist, "You are doing heaven's work, and if you delete one letter or add one letter, you destroy the entire world." In truth, copying errors crept in without destroying the entire world, and no 2 ancient Bibles were identical. A second and much bigger problem concerned interpretation. Even when people agree on the sanctity of a book and on its exact wording, they can still interpret the same words in different ways. The Bible says that you should not work on the Sabbath, but it doesn't clarify what counts as work. Is it okay to water your field on the Sabbath? What about watering your flower pots or herd of goats? Is it okay to read a book on the Sabbath? How about writing a book? How about tearing a piece of paper? The rabbis ruled that reading a book isn't work, but tearing paper is work, which is why nowadays Orthodox Jews prepare a stack of already ripped toilet paper to use on the Sabbath. The Holy Book also says that you should not cook a young goat in its mother's milk, Exodus 23:19. Some people interpreted this quite literally. If you slaughter a young goat, don't cook it in the milk of its own mother. But it's fine to cook it in the milk of an unrelated goat or in the milk of a cow. Other people interpreted this prohibition much more broadly to mean that meat and dairy products should never be mixed, so you are not allowed to have a milkshake after fried chicken. As unlikely as this may sound, most rabbis ruled that the second interpretation is the correct one, even though chickens don't lactate. More problems resulted from the fact that even if the technology of the book succeeded in limiting changes to the holy words, the world beyond the book continued to spin, and it was unclear how to relate old rules to new situations. Most biblical texts focused on the lives of Jewish shepherds and farmers in the hill country of Palestine and in the sacred city of Jerusalem. But by the 2nd century CE, most Jews lived elsewhere. A particularly large Jewish community grew in the port of Alexandria, one of the richest metropolises of the Roman Empire. A Jewish shipping magnate living in Alexandria would have found that many of the biblical laws were irrelevant to his life, while many of his pressing questions had no clear answers in the holy text. He couldn't obey the commandments about worshipping in the Jerusalem temple, because not only did he not live near Jerusalem, but the temple didn't even exist anymore. In contrast, when he contemplated whether it was kosher for him to sail his Rome-bound grain ships on the Sabbath, it turned out that long sea voyages were not considered by the authors of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Inevitably, the holy book spawned numerous interpretations, which were far more consequential than the book itself. As Jews increasingly argued over the interpretation of the Bible, rabbis gained more power and prestige. Writing down the word of Jehovah was supposed to limit the authority of the old priestly institution, but it gave rise to the authority of a new rabbinical institution. Rabbis became the Jewish technocratic elite, developing their rational and rhetorical skills through years of philosophical debates and legal disputations. The attempt to bypass fallible human institutions by relying on a new information technology backfired because of the need for a human institution to interpret the Holy Book. When the rabbis eventually reached some consensus about how to interpret the Bible, Jews saw another chance to get rid of the fallible human institution. They imagined that if they wrote the agreed interpretation in a new holy book and made numerous copies of it, that would eliminate the need for any further human intercession between them and the divine code. So, after much back and forth about which rabbinical opinions should be included and which should be ignored, a new holy book was canonized in the 3rd century CE, the Mishnah. As the Mishnah became more authoritative than the plain text of the Bible, Jews began to believe that the Mishnah could not possibly have been created by humans. It too must have been inspired by Jehovah, or perhaps even composed by the infallible deity in person. Today, many Orthodox Jews firmly believe that the Mishnah was handed to Moses by Jehovah on Mount Sinai, passed orally from generation to generation, until it was written down in the 3rd century CE. Alas, no sooner had the Mishnah been canonized and copied than Jews began arguing about the correct interpretation of the Mishnah. And when a consensus was reached about the interpretation of the Mishnah and canonized in the 5th to 6th centuries as a third holy book, the Talmud, Jews began disagreeing about the interpretation of the Talmud. The dream of bypassing fallible human institutions through the technology of the Holy Book never materialized. With each iteration, the power of the rabbinical institution only increased. Trust the infallible book turned into trust the humans who interpret the book. Judaism was shaped by the Talmud far more than by the Bible, and rabbinical arguments about the interpretation of the Talmud became even more important than the Talmud itself. This is inevitable, because the world keeps changing. The Mishnah and Talmud dealt with questions raised by second-century Jewish shipping magnates that had no clear answers in the Bible. Modernity, too, raised many new questions that have no straightforward answers in the Mishnah and Talmud. For example, when electrical appliances developed in the 20th century, Jews struggled with numerous unprecedented questions, such as whether it is okay to press the electrical buttons of an elevator on the Sabbath. The Orthodox answer is no. As noted earlier, the Bible forbids working on the Sabbath, and rabbis argued that pressing an electrical button is work because electricity is akin to fire, and it has long been established that kindling a fire is work. Does this mean that elderly Jews living in the Brooklyn high-rise must climb 100 steps to their apartment in order to avoid working on the Sabbath? Well, Orthodox Jews invented a Sabbath elevator which continually goes up and down buildings, stopping on every floor, without you having to perform any work by pressing an electrical button. The invention of AI gives another twist to this old story. By relying on facial recognition, an AI can quickly direct the elevator to your floor without making you desecrate the Sabbath. This profusion of texts and interpretations has, over time, caused a profound change in Judaism. Originally, it was a religion of priests and temples focused on rituals and sacrifices. In biblical times, the quintessential Jewish scene was a priest in blood-splattered robes sacrificing a lamb on the altar of Jehovah. Over the centuries, however, Judaism became an information religion, obsessed with texts and interpretations. From 2nd century Alexandria to 21st century Brooklyn, the quintessential Jewish scene became a group of rabbis arguing about the interpretation of a text. This change was extremely surprising, given that almost nowhere in the Bible itself do you find anyone arguing about the interpretation of any text. Such debates were not part of biblical culture itself. For example, when Korah and his followers challenged the right of Moses to lead the people of Israel and demanded a more equitable division of power, Moses reacted not by entering a learned discussion or by quoting some scriptural passage. Rather, Moses called upon God to perform a miracle, and the moment he finished speaking, the ground split, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households. Numbers 16:31-32. When Elijah was challenged by 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah to a public test in front of the people of Israel, he proved the superiority of Jehovah over Baal and Asherah first by miraculously summoning fire from the sky and then by slaughtering the pagan prophets. Nobody read any text and nobody engaged in any rational debate. 1 Kings 18. As Judaism replaced sacrifices with texts, it gravitated toward a view of information as the most fundamental building block of reality, anticipating current ideas in physics and computer science. The flood of texts generated by rabbis was increasingly seen as more important and even more real than plowing a field, baking a loaf of bread, or sacrificing a lamb in a temple. After the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans and all temple rituals ceased, rabbis nevertheless devoted enormous efforts to writing texts about the proper way to conduct temple rituals and then arguing about the correct interpretation of these texts. centuries after the temple was no more, the amount of information concerning these virtual rituals only continued to increase. The rabbis weren't oblivious to this seeming gap between text and reality. Rather, they maintained that writing texts about the rituals and arguing about these texts were far more important than actually performing the rituals. This eventually led the rabbis to believe that the entire universe was an information sphere, a realm composed of words and running on the alphabetical code of the Hebrew letters. They further maintained that this informational universe was created so that Jews could read texts and argue about their interpretation, and that if Jews ever stop reading these texts and arguing about them, the universe will cease to exist. In everyday life, this view meant that for the rabbis, words in texts were often more important than facts in the world. Or, more accurately, which words appeared in sacred texts became some of the most important facts about the world, shaping the lives of individuals and entire communities. The Split Bible. This description of the canonization of the Bible and the creation of the Mishnah and Talmud ignores one very important fact. The process of canonizing the Word of Jehovah created not one chain of texts, but several competing chains. There were people who believed in Jehovah, but not in the rabbis. Most of these dissenters did accept the first block in the biblical chain, which they called the Old Testament. But already before the rabbis sealed this block, the dissenters rejected the authority of the entire rabbinical institution, which led them to subsequently reject the Mishnah and Talmud too. These dissenters were the Christians. When Christianity emerged in the first century CE, it was not a unified religion, but rather a variety of Jewish movements that didn't agree on much, except that they all regarded Jesus Christ, rather than the rabbinical institution, as the ultimate authority on Jehovah's words. Christians accepted the divinity of texts like Genesis, Samuel, and Isaiah, but they argued that the rabbis misunderstood these texts, and only Jesus and his disciples knew the true meaning of passages like "the Lord himself will give you a sign," "the Alma will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel," Isaiah 7:14. The rabbis said Alma meant young woman, Emmanuel meant God with us. In Hebrew, Immanu means with us and El means God. And the entire passage was interpreted as a divine promise to help the Jewish people in their struggle against oppressive foreign empires. In contrast, the Christians argued that Alma meant virgin, that Emmanuel meant that God will literally be born among humans, and that this was a prophecy about the divine Jesus being born on earth to the Virgin Mary. However, by rejecting the rabbinical institution while simultaneously accepting the possibility of new divine revelations, the Christians opened the door to chaos. In the first century CE, and even more so in the second and third century CE, different Christians came up with radically new interpretations for books like Genesis and Isaiah, as well as with a plethora of new messages from God. Since they rejected the authority of the rabbis, since Jesus was dead and couldn't adjudicate between them, and since a unified Christian church didn't yet exist, who could decide which of all these interpretations and messages were divinely inspired? Thus, it was not just John who described the end of the world in his Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. We have many additional apocalypses from that era, for example, the Apocalypse of Peter, the Apocalypse of James, and even the Apocalypse of Abraham. As for the life and teachings of Jesus, in addition to the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, early Christians had the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of the Saviour, and numerous others. Similarly, aside from the Acts of the Apostles, There were at least a dozen other acts, such as the Acts of Peter and the Acts of Andrew. Letters were even more prolific. Most present-day Christian Bibles contain 14 epistles attributed to Paul, 3 attributed to John, 2 to Peter, and 1 each to James and Jude. Ancient Christians were familiar not only with additional Pauline letters, such as the Epistle to the Laodiceans, but with numerous other epistles supposedly written by other disciples and saints. As Christians composed more and more gospels, epistles, prophecies, parables, prayers, and other texts, it became harder to know which ones to pay attention to. Christians needed a curation institution. That's how the New Testament was created. At roughly the same time that debates among Jewish rabbis were producing the Mishnah and Talmud, debates among Christian priests, bishops, and theologians were producing the New Testament. In a letter from 367 CE, Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria recommended 27 texts that faithful Christians should read, a rather eclectic collection of stories, letters, and prophecies written by different people in different times and places. Athanasius recommended the Apocalypse of John, but not that of Peter or Abraham. He approved of Paul's epistle to the Galatians, but not of Paul's epistle to the Laodiceans. He endorsed the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but rejected the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Truth. A generation later, in the councils of Hippo, 393, and Carthage, 397, gatherings of bishops and theologians formally canonized this list of recommendations, which became known as the New Testament. When Christians talk about the Bible, they mean the Old Testament together with the New Testament. In contrast, Judaism never accepted the New Testament, and when Jews talk about the Bible, they mean only the Old Testament, which is supplemented by the Mishnah and Talmud. Interestingly, Hebrew to this day lacks a word to describe the Christian holy book, which contains both the Old Testament and the New Testament. Jewish thought sees them as two utterly unrelated books and simply refuses to acknowledge that there might be a single book encompassing both, even though it is probably the most common book in the world. It is crucial to note that the people who created the New Testament weren't the authors of the 27 texts it contains. They were the curators. Due to the paucity of evidence from the period, we do not know if Athanasius's list of texts reflected his personal judgment or whether it originated with earlier Christian thinkers. What we do know is that prior to the councils of Hippo and Carthage, there were rival recommendation lists for Christians. The earliest such list was codified by Marcion of Sinope in the middle of the 2nd century. The Marcion canon included only the Gospel of Luke and 10 epistles of Paul. Even these 11 texts were somewhat different from the versions later canonized at Hippo and Carthage. Either Marcion was unaware of other texts like the Gospel of John and the Book of Revelation, or he did not think highly of them. The Church Father, St. John Chrysostom, a contemporary of Bishop Athanasius's, recommended only 22 books, leaving 2 Peter, 2 John, 3 John, Jude, and Revelation out of his list. Some Christian churches in the Middle East to this day follow Chrysostom's shorter list. The Armenian Church took about 1,000 years to make up its mind about the Book of Revelation, while it included in its canon the third epistle to the Corinthians, which other churches, like the Catholic and Protestant churches, consider a forgery. The Ethiopian Church endorsed Athanasius's list in full, but added 4 other books: Synodos, the Book of Clement, the Book of the Covenant, and the Didascalia. Other lists endorsed the 2 epistles of Clement, the Visions of the Shepherd of Hermas, the Epistle of Barnabas, the Apocalypse of Peter, and various other texts that didn't make it into Athanasius' selection. We do not know the precise reasons why specific texts were endorsed or rejected by different churches, church councils, and church fathers. But the consequences were far-reaching. While churches made decisions about texts, the texts themselves shaped the churches. As a key example, consider the role of women in the church. Some early Christian leaders saw women as intellectually and ethically inferior to men, and argued that women should be restricted to subordinate roles in society and in the Christian community. These views were reflected in texts like the First Epistle to Timothy. In one of its passages, this text, attributed to St. Paul, says, "A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety." 2:11-15. But modern scholars, as well as some ancient Christian leaders like Marcion, have considered this letter a second century forgery, ascribed to St. Paul, but actually written by someone else. In opposition to 1 Timothy, during the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century CE, there were important Christian texts that saw women as equal to men, and even authorized women to occupy leadership roles, like the Gospel of Mary, or the Acts of Paul and Thecla. The latter text was written at about the same time as 1 Timothy, and for a time was extremely popular. It narrates the adventures of St. Paul and his female disciple Thecla, describing how Thecla not only performed numerous miracles, but also baptized herself with her own hands and often preached. For centuries, Thecla was one of the most revered Christian saints and was seen as evidence that women could baptize, preach, and lead Christian communities. Before the councils of Hippo and Carthage, it wasn't clear that 1 Timothy was more authoritative than the Acts of Paul and Thecla. By choosing to include 1 Timothy in their recommendation list while rejecting the Acts of Paul and Thecla, the assembled bishops and theologians shaped Christian attitudes toward women down to the present day. We can only hypothesize what Christianity might have looked like if the New Testament had included the Acts of Paul and Thecla instead of 1 Timothy. Perhaps in addition to church fathers like Athanasius, the church would have had mothers, while misogyny would have been labeled a dangerous heresy, perverting Jesus' message of universal love. Just as most Jews forgot that rabbis curated the Old Testament, so most Christians forgot that church councils curated the New Testament, and came to view it simply as the infallible Word of God. But while the Holy Book was seen as the ultimate source of authority, the process of curating the book placed real power in the hands of the curating institution. In Judaism, the canonization of the Old Testament and Mishnah went hand in hand with creating the institution of the rabbinate. In Christianity, the canonization of the New Testament went hand in hand with the creation of a unified Christian church. Christians trusted church officials, like Bishop Athanasius, because of what they read in the New Testament. But they had faith in the New Testament because this is what the bishops told them to read. The attempt to invest all authority in an infallible superhuman technology led to the rise of a new and extremely powerful human institution, the Church. The Echo Chamber. As time passed, problems of interpretation increasingly tilted the balance of power between the Holy Book and the Church in favor of the institution. Just as the need to interpret Jewish holy books empowered the rabbinate, so the need to interpret Christian holy books empowered the Church. The same saying of Jesus or the same Pauline epistle could be understood in various ways, and it was the institution that decided which reading was correct. The institution, in turn, was repeatedly shaken by struggles over the authority to interpret the Holy Book, which resulted in institutional schisms such as that between the Western Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. All Christians read the Sermon on the Mount in the Gospel of Matthew and learned that we should love our enemies, that we should turn the other cheek, and that the meek shall inherit the earth. But what did that actually mean? Christians could read this as a call to reject all use of military force or to reject all social hierarchies. The Catholic Church, however, viewed such pacifists and egalitarian readings as heresies. It interpreted Jesus' words in a way that allowed the Church to become the richest landowner in Europe, to launch violent crusades, and to establish murderous inquisitions. Catholic theology accepted that Jesus told us to love our enemies, but explained that burning heretics was an act of love because it deterred additional people from adopting heretical views, thereby saving them from the flames of hell. The French inquisitor Jacques Fournier wrote in the early 14th century an entire treatise on the Sermon on the Mount that explained how the text provided justification for hunting heretics. Fournier's view was not a fringe notion. He went on to become Pope Benedict XII, 1334-42. Fournier's task as inquisitor, and later as Pope, was to ensure that the Catholic Church's interpretation of the Holy Book would prevail. In this, Fournier and his fellow churchmen used not only violent coercion, but also their control of book production. Prior to the advent of letterpress printing in Europe in the 15th century, making many copies of a book was a prohibitive enterprise for all but the most wealthy individuals and institutions. The Catholic Church used its power and wealth to disseminate copies of its favored texts while prohibiting the production and spread of what it considered erroneous ones. Of course, the Church couldn't prevent the occasional free thinker from formulating heretical ideas, but because it controlled key nodes in the medieval information network, such as copying workshops, archives, and libraries, it could prevent such a heretic from making and distributing 100 copies of her book. To get an idea of the difficulties faced by a heretical author seeking to disseminate her views, consider that when Leofric was made Bishop of Exeter in 1050, he found just 5 books in the cathedral's library. He immediately established a copying workshop in the cathedral, but in the 22 years before he died in 1072, his copyists produced only 66 additional volumes. In the 13th century, the Library of Oxford University consisted of a few books kept in a chest under St. Mary's Church. In 1424, the Library of Cambridge University boasted a grand total of only 122 books. An Oxford University decree from 1409 stipulated that all recent texts studied at the university must be unanimously approved by a panel of 12 theologians appointed by the Archbishop. The Church sought to lock society inside an echo chamber, allowing the spread only of those books that supported it, and people trusted the Church because almost all the books supported it. Even illiterate laypersons who didn't read books were still awed by recitations of these precious texts or expositions on their content. That's how the belief in a supposedly infallible superhuman technology like the New Testament led to the rise of an extremely powerful but fallible human institution like the Catholic Church that crushed all opposing views as erroneous while allowing no one to question its own views. Catholic information experts such as Jacques Fournier spent their days reading Thomas Aquinas' interpretation of Augustine's interpretation of St. Paul's epistles and composing additional interpretations of their own. All those interrelated texts didn't represent reality. They created a new information sphere, even bigger and more powerful than that created by the Jewish rabbis. Medieval Europeans were cocooned inside that information sphere. their daily activities, thoughts, and emotions shaped by texts about texts about texts. Print, science, and witches. The attempt to bypass human fallibility by investing authority in an infallible text never succeeded. If anyone thought this was due to some unique flaw of the Jewish rabbis or the Catholic priests, the Protestant Reformation repeated the experiment again and again, always getting the same results. Luther, Calvin, and their successors argued that there was no need for any fallible human institution to interpose itself between ordinary people and the Holy Book. Christians should abandon all the parasitical bureaucracies that grew around the Bible and reconnect to the original Word of God. But the Word of God never interpreted itself, which is why not only Lutheran and Calvinists, but numerous other Protestant sects eventually established their own church institutions and invested them with the authority to interpret the text and persecute heretics. If infallible texts merely lead to the rise of fallible and oppressive churches, how then to deal with the problem of human error? The naive view of information posits that the problem can be solved by creating the opposite of a church, namely a free market of information. The naive view expects that if all restrictions on the free flow of information are removed, error will inevitably be exposed and displaced by truth. As noted in the prologue, this is wishful thinking. Let's delve a little deeper to understand why. As a test case, consider what happened during one of the most celebrated epochs in the history of information networks, the European Print Revolution. The introduction of the printing press to Europe in the mid-15th century made it possible to mass-produce texts relatively quickly, cheaply, and secretly, even if the Catholic Church disapproved of them. It is estimated that in the 46 years from 1454 to 1500, more than 12 million volumes were printed in Europe. By contrast, in the previous 1,000 years, only about 11 million volumes were hand-copied. By 1600, all kinds of fringe people, heretics, revolutionaries, proto-scientists, could disseminate their writings much more rapidly, widely, and easily than ever before. In the history of information networks, the print revolution of early modern Europe is usually hailed as a moment of triumph, breaking the stranglehold that the Catholic Church had maintained over the European information network. Allegedly, by allowing people to exchange information much more freely than before, it led to the scientific revolution. There is a grain of truth in this. Without print, it would certainly have been much harder for Copernicus, Galileo, and their colleagues to develop and spread their ideas. But print wasn't the root cause of the scientific revolution. The only thing the printing press did was to faithfully reproduce texts. The machine had no ability to come up with any new ideas of its own. Those who connect print to science assumed that the mere act of producing and spreading more information inevitably leads people to the truth. In fact, print allowed the rapid spread not only of scientific facts, but also of religious fantasies, fake news, and conspiracy theories. Perhaps the most notorious example of the latter was the belief in a worldwide conspiracy of satanic witches, which led to the witch hunt craze that engulfed early modern Europe. Belief in magic and in witches has characterized human societies on all continents and in all eras. But different societies imagined witches and reacted to them in very different ways. Some societies believed that witches controlled spirits, talked with the dead, and predicted the future. Others imagined that witches stole cattle and located hidden treasure. In one community, witches were thought to cause disease, blight cornfields, and concoct love potions, while in another community they supposedly entered houses at night, performed household chores, and stole milk. In some locales, witches were thought to be mostly female, while in others they were generally imagined to be male. Some cultures were terrified of witches and persecuted them violently, but others tolerated or even honored them. Finally, there were societies on every continent and in every era that gave witches little importance. For most of the Middle Ages, most European societies belonged to the latter category and were not overly concerned about witches. The medieval Catholic Church didn't see them as a major threat to humanity, and some churchmen actively discouraged witch hunting. According to the influential 10th century text, Canon Episcopi, which defined medieval church doctrine on the matter, witchcraft was mostly illusion, and belief in the reality of witchcraft was an unchristian superstition. The European witch hunt craze was a modern rather than a medieval phenomenon. In the 1420s and 1430s, churchmen and scholars operating mainly in the Alps region took elements from Christian religion, local folklore, and Greco-Roman heritage and amalgamated them into a new theory of witchcraft. Previously, even when witches were dreaded, they were considered a strictly local problem. Isolated criminals who, inspired by personal malevolence, used magical means to commit theft and murder. In contrast, the new scholarly model argued that witches were a far more formidable threat to society. There was allegedly a global conspiracy of witches led by Satan, which constituted an institutionalized anti-Christian religion. Its purpose was nothing less than the complete destruction of the social order and of humankind. Witches were said to gather at night in huge demonic assemblies where they worshipped Satan, killed children, ate human flesh, engaged in orgies, and cast spells that caused storms, epidemics, and other catastrophes. Inspired by such ideas, the first mass witch hunts and witch trials were led by local churchmen and noblemen in the Valais region of the Western Alps between 1428 and 1436, leading to the execution of more than 200 supposed male and female witches. From this Alpine heartland, rumors about the global witch conspiracy trickled to other parts of Europe. But the belief was still far from mainstream. The Catholic establishment did not embrace it, and other regions didn't launch large-scale witch hunts like those in the Valais. In 1485, a Dominican friar and inquisitor called Heinrich Kramer embarked on a witch-hunting expedition in another Alpine region, the Austrian Tyrol. Kramer was a fervent convert to the new belief in a global satanic conspiracy. He also seems to have been mentally unhinged, and his accusations of satanic witchcraft were colored by rabid misogyny and odd sexual fixations. Local church authorities, led by the Bishop of Brixen, were skeptical of Kramer's accusations and alarmed by his activities. They stopped his inquisition, released the suspects he arrested, and expelled him from the area. Kramer hit back through the printing press. Within 2 years of his banishment, he compiled and published the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of the Witches. This was a do-it-yourself guidebook to exposing and killing witches, in which Kramer described in detail the worldwide conspiracy and the means by which honest Christians could uncover and foil the witches. In particular, he recommended the use of horrific methods of torture in order to extract confessions from people suspected of witchcraft, and was adamant that the only punishment for the guilty was execution. Kramer organized and codified previous ideas and stories, and added many details from his own fertile and hate-filled imagination. Relying on ancient Christian misogynist teachings like those of 1 Timothy, Kramer sexualized witchcraft. He argued that witches were typically female because witchcraft originated in lust, which was supposedly stronger in women. He warned readers that sex could cause a pious woman to become a witch and her husband to become bewitched. An entire chapter of The Hammer is dedicated to the ability of witches to steal men's penises. Kramer discusses at length whether the witches are really able to take away the male member from its owner, or whether they are only able to create an illusion of castration in men's minds. Kramer asks, what is to be thought of those witches who in this way sometimes collect male organs in great numbers, as many as 20 or 30 members together, and put them in a bird's nest or shut them up in a box, where they can move themselves like living members, and eat oats and corn, as has been seen by many? He then relates a story he heard from one man. When he had lost his member, he approached a known witch to ask her to restore it to him. She told the afflicted man to climb a certain tree, and that he might take which he liked out of the nest in which there were several members. And when he tried to take a big one, the witch said, "You must not take that one," adding, "because it belongs to a parish priest." Numerous notions about witches that are still popular today, for instance, that witches are predominantly women, that witches engage in wild sexual activities, and that witches kill and mutilate children, were given their canonical form by Kramer's book. Like the Bishop of Brixen, other churchmen were initially skeptical of Kramer's wild ideas, and there was some resistance to the book among church experts. But The Hammer of the Witches became one of the biggest bestsellers of early modern Europe. It catered to people's deepest fears, as well as to their lurid interest in hearing about orgies, cannibalism, child murders, and satanic conspiracies. The book had gone through 8 editions by 1500, another 5 by 1520, and 16 more by 1670, with many vernacular translations. It became the definitive work on witchcraft and witch hunting, and inspired a host of imitations and elaborations. As Kramer's fame grew, his work was embraced by the church experts. Kramer was appointed papal representative and made inquisitor of Bohemia and Moravia in 1500. Even today, his ideas continue to shape the world, and many current theories about a global satanic conspiracy, like QAnon, draw upon and perpetuate his fantasies. While it would be an exaggeration to argue that the invention of print caused the European witch hunt craze, the printing press played a pivotal role in the rapid dissemination of the belief in the global satanic conspiracy. As Kramer's ideas gained popularity, printing presses produced not only many additional copies of The Hammer of the Witches and copycat books, but also a torrent of cheap one-page pamphlets whose sensational texts were often accompanied by illustrations depicting people attacked by demons or witches burned at the stake. These publications also gave fantastic statistics about the size of the witches' conspiracy. For example, the Burgundian judge and witch hunter, Henri Bouguer, 1550-1619, speculated that there were 300,000 witches in France alone, and 1.8 million in all of Europe. Such claims fueled mass hysteria, which in the 16th and 17th centuries led to the torture and execution of between 40,000 and 50,000 innocent people who were accused of witchcraft. The victims included individuals from all walks of life and ages, including children as young as 5. People began denouncing one another for witchcraft on the flimsiest evidence, often to avenge personal slights or to gain economic and political advantage. Once an official investigation began, the accused were often doomed. The inquisitorial methods recommended by the Hammer of the Witches were truly diabolical. If the accused confessed to being a witch, they were executed and their property divided between the accuser, the executioner, and the inquisitors. If the accused refused to confess, this was taken as evidence of their demonic obstinacy, and they were then tortured in horrendous ways, their fingers broken, their flesh cut with hot pincers, their bodies stretched to the breaking point or submerged in boiling water. Sooner or later, they could stand it no longer and confessed, and were duly executed. To take one example, in 1600, authorities in Munich arrested on suspicion of witchcraft the Pappenheimer family, Father Paulus, Mother Anna, two grown sons, and a 10-year-old boy, Hansel. The inquisitors began by torturing little Hansel. The protocol of the interrogation, which can still be read in the Munich archives, has a note from one of the interrogators regarding the 10-year-old boy. May be tortured to the limit so that he incriminates his mother. After being tortured in unspeakable ways, the Pappenheimers confessed to numerous crimes, including killing 265 people by sorcery and causing 14 destructive storms. They were all condemned to death. The bodies of each of the four adult family members were torn with red-hot pincers. The men's limbs were broken on the wheel. The father was impaled on a stake. The mother's breasts were cut off, and all were then burned alive. The 10-year-old Hansel was forced to watch all this. 4 months later, he too was executed. The witch hunters were extremely thorough in their search for the devil and his accomplices. But if the witch hunters really wanted to find diabolical evil, they just had to look in the mirror. The Spanish Inquisition to the rescue. Witch hunts seldom ended by killing just one person or one family. Since the underlying model postulated a global conspiracy, people accused of witchcraft were tortured to name accomplices. This was then used as evidence to imprison, torture, and execute others. If any officials, scholars, or churchmen voiced objections to these absurd methods, this could be seen as proof that they too must be witches, which led to their own arrest and torture. For example, in 1453, when belief in the satanic conspiracy was just beginning to take hold, a French doctor of theology called Guillaume Edelin bravely sought to quash it before it spread. He repeated the claims of the medieval canon episcopi that witchcraft was an illusion and that witches couldn't really fly at night to meet Satan and make a pact with him. Edelin was then himself accused of being a witch and arrested. Under torture, he confessed that he personally had flown on a broomstick and signed a pact with the devil, and that it was Satan who commissioned him to preach that witchcraft was an illusion. His judges were lenient with him. He was spared execution and got life imprisonment instead. The witch hunts illustrate the dark side of creating an information sphere. As with rabbinical discussions of the Talmud and scholastic discussions of Christian scriptures, the witch hunts were fueled by an expanding ocean of information that instead of representing reality, created a new reality. Witches were not an objective reality. Nobody in early modern Europe had sex with Satan or was capable of flying on broomsticks and creating hailstorms. But witches became an intersubjective reality. Like money, witches were made real by exchanging information about witches. An entire witch-hunting bureaucracy dedicated itself to such exchanges. Theologians, lawyers, inquisitors, and the owners of printing presses made a living by collecting and producing information about witches, cataloguing different species of witches, investigating how witches behaved, and recommending how they could be exposed and defeated. Professional witch hunters offered their services to governments and municipalities, charging large sums of money. Archives were filled by detailed reports of witch hunting expeditions, protocols of witch trials, and lengthy confessions extracted from the alleged witches. Expert witch hunters used all that data to refine their theories further. Like scholars arguing about the correct interpretation of scripture, the witch hunters debated the correct interpretation of The Hammer of the Witches and other influential books. The witch-hunting bureaucracy did what bureaucracy often does. It invented the intersubjective category of witches and imposed it on reality. It even printed forms with standard accusations and confessions of witches and blank spaces left for dates, names, and the signature of the accused. All that information produced a lot of order and power. It was a means for certain people to gain authority and for society as a whole to discipline its members. But it produced zero truth and zero wisdom. As the witch-hunting bureaucracy generated more and more information,